From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We are 1 week post-primary and the race for governor is set. Republican Steve Hilton and Democrat Javier Becerra will advance to the November runoff, capping off an unusual gubernatorial race. With the general now set when it comes to the governor's race, we're going to have a postmortem about the lingering themes of this election. Laurel Rosenhall is a New York Times reporter covering California politics and government and joins us now. Welcome, Laurel.
Hi, Vicky.
So this isn't your first rodeo when it comes to elections or covering governors. What are your big takeaways from this primary?
I think we can't escape the omnipresence of billionaires and other wealthy people in this race. Obviously, one of the candidates, Democrat Tom Steyer, is a billionaire, and he campaigned on a platform of being the billionaire willing to tax billionaires. But then we also had some other races, like in San Francisco and in Silicon Valley, some people running for Congress who were self-funding their campaigns. And, you know, in all of those cases, even though the politics were not always the same, but there did seem to be some voter backlash to the idea of electing billionaires. That seemed to be one of the themes, this sort of feeling of class warfare. You know, we heard a lot of voters talking about their concerns about affordability, and the candidates were trying to speak to those. But layered on top of that, I think, was a sense of, are people walking the walk or just talking the talk?
Yeah, I mean, Tom Steyer came up short in third place for the governor's race. And he did acknowledge, I think, the fact that he was self-funding his campaign and I guess his concession speech, right?
Yeah. And he said that he understood that many people just couldn't sort of stomach voting for a billionaire, which was kind of an amazing statement to make in his concession remarks. But he also sort of stuck to this idea that he's a class traitor and that he would continue doing everything he could to fight against an economic system that, that benefits billionaires.
You reported that this was the most expensive governor's race in U.S. history. It's not over yet. I mean, what drove this? Is it just billionaires like Tom Steyer, or are there other influences behind this level of spending?
Yeah, so I reported that it's from an analysis by Ad Impact, which is a company that tracks advertising spending. And what drove it really was Tom Steyer. I mean, his spending was responsible for almost two-thirds of every dollar spent in this primary in California, at least for the governor's race. And so his spending kind of knocked it into that sort of history-making level of expenses on political campaigning. I'm sure anyone who watches TV noticed that his commercials were on all the time. That costs money, and he spent more than $200 million on that, and just kind of swamped the competition in terms of, you know, what others spent just was a fraction of that.
Mm. Did that then kind of spark counter campaign fundraising for parties or entities that wanted to campaign against Tom Steyer, like they would go and support other candidates?
Yes. And even Steyer's, you know, supporters even acknowledged that it did kind of create a little bit of an arms race. No one came close to the $200 million that Tom Steyer spent, but supporters, there are many companies that were opposing Tom Steyer and supporting Javier Becerra kind of collectively spent close to $55 million on their campaign. So yes, they were spending too, and they were doing their own attack ads. But again, that's $55 million on one side compared to more than $200 million on the other.
Yeah, that's just a quarter. It's just a fraction of what Tom Steyer spent of his personal savings. There was also the influence of Silicon Valley and tech in ways that we haven't really seen before. What stood out to you about this influence in the primary?
So there were a couple of people. It did seem to be a major blowout for big tech. I mean, obviously, and I'll get to my caveat in a minute, but to a lot of figures from Silicon Valley were backing Matt Mahan for governor. He's the mayor of San Jose. And his campaign just never took off. You know, they put a lot of money into that, and he kind of sort of grew only marginally in the polling, but he remained in the single digits the entire campaign. So that was a big loss for Silicon Valley. There were a couple of candidates who were running for Congress in the Bay Area that were backed by Silicon Valley. Some Silicon Valley folks who opposed the billionaires tax that could be on the ballot in November had tried to back a Democratic challenger for Congressman Ro Khanna in the San Jose area, and that went nowhere. Their candidate did not, did not win. And then in San Francisco, for the seat that Nancy Pelosi has, there was a challenger there who is, you know, more progressive than the kind of typical Silicon Valley billionaire class, but he is someone who made a lot of money from his working in tech, and he self-financed a campaign to try to run for Congress in San Francisco and spent almost $10 million of his own money. And he also lost there, so he's not moving on to the general election. So there were some noteworthy losses for big tech and for executives who come out of that world. On the other hand, I will point out they did have a couple of wins that I need to make note of. There were some legislative races where their committees did very well, and then there also was a ballot measure in San Francisco that unions were supporting to create a new tax on companies that have very high paid CEOs. And that was defeated. So those were some sort of wins for the Silicon Valley crowd. But the biggest things, the sort of marquee things, governor, Congress, those things, they lost big.
It seems like the collective views of Californians can be reflected in these votes when affordability is top of mind for many residents. It's, I guess, off-putting, voting for a billionaire for some voters, and also tech as well, and tech's increasing role in our lives for better or for worse. It can be frustrating for a lot of people. So maybe you can see that in how people voted for this primary. Why were Hilton and Becerra so successful in a crowded race? I mean, it was an unusual campaign, of course, a crowded field with curveballs, but ultimately these two did rise to the top.
Mm-hmm. So I think it's easier to answer on the Hilton side because there were fewer Republicans running and he was endorsed by President Trump. And so for Republican voters, that is an influential endorsement, and that helped kind of solidify the Republican voters behind Hilton. On the Democratic side, it was a very messy race, and there were many, many, many candidates, and a field that felt like, if I think about kind of having covered this race, honestly, for the last 2 years, I mean, the field has completely shifted over the course of those 2 years. You know, a couple of years ago, we were talking about Eleni Kounoulakis, the lieutenant governor, or Tony Atkins, the Senate leader, as, candidates. They dropped out early on. There was discussion about whether Kamala Harris would get in or Alex Padilla. They never entered the race. And so once things kind of solidified earlier this year with who was really actually going to run, Eric Swalwell started to kind of attract a lot of momentum, and he seemed to become a pretty predominant contender. I mean, he was a front runner for sure. There was a lot of signs pointing toward he would become the front runner. And obviously when he was accused of sexual assault and other misconduct by multiple women, he dropped out of the race. He resigned from Congress, and the whole thing, reorganized. And at that moment, it was a very good moment to be kind of a just boring person with a long track record, I think, and kind of after a lot of the Swalwell supporters felt very burned by having taken a risk on supporting him. Becerra kind of became someone who was a known quantity and for a more risk-averse kind of voter or interest group became someone who seemed like a better choice. So, I mean, I think that is how he rose to the top was because, again, this large and uncertain field that was then totally shook up by the Swalwell resignation. And then I guess lastly, I would just say he also benefited from the Democrats' anxiety about our top two system and the possibility that two Republicans could be elected for the top two spots, because we obviously have this system that the two people who get the most votes move on to the general election. It doesn't matter what party they are. And so a lot of voters just kind of wanted to vote for whatever Democrat had enough support to keep that from happening. And so that helped him. And I think that helped him a lot in the end.
Yeah. So perhaps like the safe choice for voters in kind of a volatile, crowded race when it came to Democratic candidates. What's also interesting is like back in March or February, Becerra was polling in the single digits. He was among that group that the Democratic Party in California was asking to reassess your campaign to kind of thin the herd a bit. And Katie Porter was polling higher at that time. I think Steyer was polling higher at that time too, but they didn't absorb Swalwell as much as Becerra did. I mean, looking at the debate stage come May, I mean, Katie Porter was the lone woman running for governor. Betty Yee at that point had backed out. Tony Atkins last year, Eleni Kounoulakis moved to another race. And in reporting that you contributed to, California is actually a minority when it comes to states that have never had a woman governor. What did you learn about why that might be in a state that likes to be deep blue, especially with that national lens and progressive?
One factor is definitely the size of our state. It's, you know, it's the most populous state in the nation. We have multiple media markets. So running a campaign in California means, you know, raising enough money to get yourself known in a lot of different places. And that means a lot of media exposure because, you know, ads, basically. It's not a state where you can really go shake hands with the majority of voters. I mean, and so that is a big factor, is the size of the state makes it expensive. And expensive campaigns, you know, have a history of disadvantaging women who are, you know, less inclined to fundraise, less comfortable with fundraising historically. And then I think there's also, you have to acknowledge the aspect of, you know, a certain amount of bias in our society, where there are, you know, behaviors that women are held accountable for that aren't always the same level of accountability is not always applied to male candidates. But California's size is definitely one factor in that. And even though we have had some, you know, barrier-breaking female politicians from this state, and I'm thinking of Nancy Pelosi, who was the first woman Speaker of the House, or Kamala Harris, the first female vice president, those people kind of, Kamala Harris did run for attorney general, and that's a statewide contest. And but Nancy Pelosi obviously came up through San Francisco. It's a smaller, you know, area of voters. And Kamala Harris became vice president appointed by Joe Biden, one person. So so there are just different factors at play. And who knows when it'll be California's turn, but not this year.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Laurel Rosenhall with The New York Times about covering the governor's race. So this comes up for most elections. Why does it take so long in California for ballots to be counted? And not only that, but when races get called, there's usually some confusion. Why is the AP or whoever like calling a race before all votes are counted? So just kind of a nice reminder 101, how does it all work?
Yeah. So the simplest answer for why it takes so long is because we're a huge state and we have transitioned to almost entirely voting by mail. That's the shortest, easiest way to say it. There are a lot of component parts to that that feed into it. And so to begin with, you know, it used to be that in California, if you voted by mail, your ballot had to be received by election day in the election offices. Well, the law was changed and now it has to be postmarked by election day and received within 7 days after the election. So right there, you have a certain amount of ballots that are going to come in after election day. And the state just sort of assumes that there is going to be at least 7 more days of counting. Another thing is that in shifting to sending everyone a ballot in the mail and providing an envelope for them to send it back or drop it at a drop box, that actually really slows things down, because when people turn in their ballots in an envelope, it's very, very cumbersome for election officials to process that compared with just a ballot, the old-fashioned way. If you just had a ballot and you dropped your ballot in the box at a polling place, you know, it could just be processed. The vote would be tabulated on that ballot because you had already kind of come in, checked in, you know, all of that, and then they just counted your vote. When you have an envelope, it requires many, many more steps. First, they have to look at your signature on the back of the envelope and match it to your signature on file. Make sure that that signature matches, that it's really you. Then the envelopes have to be opened. Then the ballots have to be inspected to make sure that they're not, you know, messed up or have like extra markings or other things. Then they count the votes. So it's much more cumbersome to, you know, receive ballots in an envelope. That is a major factor. And then also, you know, the counties basically decide how much they want to spend on administering elections and how much they're going to invest in their operations. And that varies widely. Some of them have more staffing, some of them have less staffing, some of them have more equipment, some of them have less equipment. And so there is not a lot of, you know, uniformity across the 58 counties of California. And then we are an extremely populous state. You know, there's 20 million registered voters. There's more voters in LA County alone than there are in a lot of states in the United States. So just the scale of things is very huge, but, you know, we all remember that wasn't always like this. We used to have our counts in faster, but that again was before voting by mail was as prevalent as it is now.
And essentially when it comes to calling a race, it's just statistics, right? Like that you can't get, like Steyer wouldn't be able to absorb enough votes to surpass like Hilton, for example.
Exactly. They just, you know, they look at, this is not my world of expertise, but the you know, the data analysts who do this race calling, they're looking at what's the gap between the person who's lagging and the winner, and is there a statistical possibility of them catching up? And when there's not, that's when they declare a race call.
Given the stress over this primary's top two, either, you know, top two Democrats, top two Republicans advancing, I mean, there is that talk of ranked choice and why we don't have that. Is that even a possibility in California, or even just going back to how we did elections before we had a jungle primary?
It's a possibility. It would require a vote by the people of California to see if they wanted to do that change. But it could be. There is a movement to return to a partisan primary where you would have the top candidate from each party appear on the general election ballot. That proposal may be on the ballot in 2028 for Californians to vote on. There's an effort to do that, but it's kind of a ways away from knowing, you know, how, if it will be on the ballot and if it would be approved. There also is a movement for ranked choice voting. As far as I know that there, it's being attempted in a lot of different cities, and people may see that there's signature collection going on to do ranked choice voting in Sacramento. I'm not aware of any kind of statewide campaign, though I know that there is like an ambition and a goal for people who support ranked choice voting, but I'm not aware of any particular exact, you know, initiative that they have put forward. But it could happen. There is a, like you said, this there was a lot of anxiety this year about the top two primary, more than I've seen in 15 years of California having the top two primary. This seemed to be the first time that there was just like a real whole lot of hand-wringing about the system. And so it wouldn't surprise me if people who want to change it kind of capitalize on this year's election to try to make a change. But again, that would require people voting, and maybe in 2 years, by the time there's a vote on it, maybe people won't be as upset about it anymore. And also, you know, a lot of people don't like the political parties. And so going back to a system that empowers the parties to have more control over the elections, you know, it's not a slam dunk.
Yeah. Finally, in the last 30 seconds or so that we have, I'm just curious what you're interested in following now that we're squaring straight ahead to the governor's race for the general. I mean, it's going to be a milestone in a sense, regardless of how it shakes out. California hasn't had a Republican as governor for 2 decades. If Becerra is elected, he would be the first Latino governor in the modern era for the Golden State. So what are you going to be following in the next, you know, 5 months and change?
Well, both of those are, you know, interesting questions and things I'll be looking at, and just kind of exploring the significance of having a Latino governor. What does it mean? What does it reflect about our state? And so that's one thing I'll be looking at. And Steve Hilton is a lively personality with who really, you know, knows how to use media. And so I think that he will wage an interesting campaign, and we'll be following that, too.
Laurel, as always, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Laurel Rosenhall is a New York Times reporter covering California politics and government. We've been discussing her coverage of the governor's race. Up next, scientists collected samples across the San Joaquin Valley last year to learn more about the species that call these places home, and the InSight team went along for the ride. Now we have the results. We'll talk to scientists about what they found. You're listening to InSight on CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.